Quite an agenda, really, tonight. There's two topics on the agenda, and then after those, I'd like to take about 5 minutes and do some scheduling with council about a May work session, an August budget work session, and then just let you know that you have received an email, which is an amendment sheet for revised bill B99-12 about bonds. And the email to look for is from Fred Bachman. I'll pull that up for the meeting, the next meeting. So, well, actually, can we do the calendars first? Then we'll move into the rest. So the first meeting date we're looking for is something in May to do a work session for our labor groups to come to council. This is the part of the process where if the group feels they haven't made the progress they wanted, they can come speak to council. There are two that would like to, so we're looking for a half an hour at some point in your
schedule. Don't have any room on the 21st.
We had a three-hour strategic planning meeting. 2 to 5, I mean, we could go from 5 to 5:30 if you want.
At 5 o'clock?
What date?
21st.
We don't have any mega issues on for the 21st that you know of.
No? That's right.
We're not?
There's no pre-council that night, so we could do 5 to 5:30.
5 to 5:30. Let's do that.
Okay. Me.
And? Then in August, after August 10th, we need to work in a day for budget work session. Last year, we took a whole Saturday and walked through the budget. We could do that again, or we could do two weeknight sort of evening meetings. It's really up to council. On your preference, would you like to give up a Saturday or two weeknights in August?
Go to weeknights.
I prefer it Saturday, but so if anyone else has an opinion, I could do it 2 weeknights if that's better for a tough week. Nobody else has a, and I'll yield to Helen's seniority and. Okay. We can do 2 weeknights.
Work though, I mean, without me, what do we do?
Budget.
Oh no, maybe that's not.
I'd prefer you all to be there.
I'd rather do one Saturday, personally. Okay.
Can I just ask then, if we're going to do a Saturday, can we do either the 4th or the 11th?
Before what?
4th or the 11th?
We need it to be after the 10th, so the 11th would be John. In the room? I believe we can accommodate the 11th.
For anyone else?
That works for me.
We have the 11th, 18th, or 25th as options. 25th?
Is the 18th bad for you?
Yeah. For sure.
I may be out of town on the 11th. I can't.
How about the 25th?
I can't tell you for sure. Unfortunately, I'd rather do it next to a council meeting, but I guess the timing didn't work.
25th right? Is good for me.
That's good. But the 18th, let's just do the 18th.
The 18th is just before a council meeting.
Okay.
So we'll all probably pretty much be here.
How long on the 18th?
All day.
We'll buy lunch.
all the
4
Saturdays.
You know, 8 to 5.
8 to 5.
And we'll try to be done by 3
it's
or 4.
It's August, right? You're talking
August.
August,
yeah. So the 25th?
Okay.
25th?
Or did we say 18th?
Sorry. 18th.
I thought we said the 18th.
Because we have a meeting on the 20th.
What time we start?
About 8 o'clock. 8 till 5. It's probably a good time frame to book out.
About Fred?
Oh, we'll follow up and if it needs to change, we'll ask again. We're far enough out, we can adjust, I think. Right now, we're looking at the 18th. Okay. Well, thank you for that. With all that, we can jump right into the city natural resource inventory.
Thank you for having me here this evening to give you an overview and update of the natural resources inventory. I'm Matt Garricky, GIS manager within the city's GIS office. And like many of you, this project predates my time with the city. When this idea started and the different data parts of this started and a lot of the different stakeholder meetings and conversations, we had pretty much an entirely different council, and several of our department heads have changed as well. And so this is kind of an opportunity to just talk about it, let you know where we're at, and some of the next steps for this particular project. What is a natural resource inventory? It's pretty much collecting all of the different possible data that we can about what types of natural resources, things that are going on in our community that relate to natural resources. And beyond collecting that data, trying to analyze it, categorize it, summarize it to provide information that city staff and the public can use to better understand our community and what's going on in our community. We're doing this at the scale of the metro area, which is a little bit larger than the city itself, and includes base data like aerial photography, a land cover map, both of which for this project were new or newly generated to support this, a compilation of all sorts of other GIS data, either that the city already had and used operationally, or data like soils from the U.S. Geological Survey and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, floodplain data from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, all sorts of other data that we could come up with or that people could think of that might help us better understand our community. The genesis for this project started in 2006. And it has gone on and is nearing completion in this phase, but that's towards the tail end of this particular presentation. And data stakeholders have included not just city staff, but the community in terms of what's been talked about and what this information can provide. The natural resource inventory area is about the same, a little bit bigger than the Columbia Metropolitan Planning Area. It includes all of the city of Columbia, but also extends a bit beyond there to try to think about the growth of the city, and is still smaller than most of Boone County, but takes up most of that that central part of our county and I-70 and U.S. 63 running through it. The key outcomes for the natural resource inventory are really trying to understand what's out there. You know, where do we have impervious surface? Where do we have cropland? Where do we have water? Where do we have forest? What different types of forest do we have? What are the other different developments and uses and infrastructure that help us understand or are constrained by what's out there in the natural environment? And so the documentation of these different geographical resources is, let's map it, let's figure out where it is, and let's use this snapshot in time to provide a benchmark, a baseline, so in the future we can see how these different things change. Much of the analysis is based on, once we understand where things are, what's going on between them, what are the interrelations, what are the connections, what do we learn or better understand about our environment that we didn't necessarily know or understand or have the data to support before? With most projects, the more we look at it, the more other questions arise and the more opportunities to think about what's out there or other data we might look for. And so it's always kind of hard to figure out what makes the project now and then what are the spin-offs of the project that we can continue to look at and develop and try to provide a way to better understand. Within the community, at different points during this process, many different city committees and working groups and organizations outside of a city government itself have been involved, have been given presentations, different copies of the draft plans, and asked for feedback and comment. And those comments have been received and to some extent reintegrated into the process. Within the city, data stakeholders include several different city departments, including water and light, community development, and public works. But this also benefits the Columbia Area Transportation Study Organization, CATSO, Boone County, and the University of Missouri as well. From the origin of this idea in 2006, updates have been provided at several different meetings and council work sessions, and I've tried to intersperse these on these next couple slides with what's been happening on that data end of the project. And so after a December 2006 a work session presentation, there was the go-ahead to procure the particular imagery which is used for this project. Once that imagery was flown, it took almost a year to process before we saw the results of that and could turn that over to the University of Missouri research group, of which was kind of the contractor for some of this analysis. Simultaneously over that time period, there was a public open house, there was meetings within city staff and city council updates, and presentation to the Energy and Environment Commission. And city staff were doing some analysis with the data that they had access to. After the University of Missouri delivered their part of the work in 2010, staff was able to review that data, do some analysis that led to the draft summary report, which was distributed to council and is up available on our website. And we've managed to incorporate several different features of the data products of this project in different ways as we've been working through other parts of the project, the most notable one being the City View web map, which we debuted last November. One of the base maps includes some tree canopy data and information, and also shows some of the other data that we compiled to support some of the other analyses. And that brings us up to today's update and overview. When we talk about natural resources and things that help us better understand natural resources, the list can get rather extensive. And so the largest data set that's really new with this project is the land cover data set, which we'll talk about in a little bit more detail. Most of the other items on this list are different examples of data or information that we're pulling or borrowing from other sources, from other data sets, and trying to better understand with some sort of analysis. For example, the tree canopy, the coverage and composition is derived from that land cover data set, and understanding the tree canopy helps us understand the habitat and what different habitat types there are throughout the city and throughout the metro area. Those particular habitat types might be impacted by the physiography and relief, and so depending on the slopes or the facing of some slopes or the slope aspects or the different soils that are there, those in turn may affect habitat, especially for the types of plants that we might find in some of those particular areas. And so in that regard, it's not just one data set, but it's a lot of interacting data sets that try to help provide some analysis. The few different reports that we've formally issued over the course of this project include the internal summary report, which was released in October 2009, and then the draft report of October 2010. And where we're at in the process is finishing up some of the data analysis, trying to come up with the final version of some data so that we can go back and update all of the different maps and tables and charts that were in the review draft report. The most time-intensive part of this process has been actually generating the land use land cover map. And so the land cover is what we find at the surface of the earth. The land use is how the land is used. Sometimes we see land cover data sets. Sometimes we see land use data sets. The approach we're using here is a little bit more integrated, where we have characteristics like grassland and we have characteristics like tree canopy, but then we also have a disturbed land or an urban impervious land use. To support the development of this land use land cover data set, the city flew 6-inch aerial photography in June of 2007. The imagery that was used for this is considered leaf on, which just means we flew it when all the trees were in bloom. And that allows us to emphasize where the tree canopy is as opposed to where the tree stands are. If we use leaf off and we can see through the deciduous leaves, we kind of get an area of where the trunks are.
Would you explain what 6-inch aerial photography is?
6-inch aerial photography means that if you zoom in all the way to the point to where the picture starts to break up and you start seeing all those little pixels that make up a picture, that each one of those will measure 6 inches by 6 inches. When this imagery was flown, the best that was commercially available or publicly available for the city was 1-meter imagery, which means you could zoom in and it would start breaking up sooner because those pixels were, you know, larger than 6 inches. In a second, I'll zoom in and show an example of what that means and the level of detail that can provide. Yes?
My memory was we discussed having two flyovers, one without the vegetation early and one without, but only one with and one without. So we only did the with vegetation.
The city paid for the leaf on. The county flew leaf off earlier in 2007 that through our data sharing agreements we have access to and we have used for part of this.
Thanks.
So what the 6-inch aerial photography gives us is a great amount of detail, not only with the imagery and what we can see, but the resulting data that's provided from that. The leaf on enables us to better understand the tree canopy, the tree species, but it does provide one limitation. If we're looking at the tree canopy and valuing that, we're looking at kind of the trees, and then if something's covered by the tree canopy, we're not as concerned about that because we're privileging the canopy and the information about that. The example is that if you have a large oak tree and it covers half your house, in our land use land cover data set, we're only going to see the half of the house that isn't covered by the tree, you know, because we're putting that emphasis on the tree canopy data. For the land use land cover data set, it's organized primarily into 6 classes, and those are on the left: forest, water, impervious surface, cropland, disturbed land, and grass. That forest class is subdivided into 11 other classes, each of which break out the different types and associations of tree species that we have. associated usually if it's older or younger, if it's more of a regular forest or somewhat of a mixed forest in terms of species. So the basis of the analysis is the 6-inch imagery, and if we zoom in off of Butternut Court here, you can see that we can zoom in quite a bit and still achieve a lot of detail. So each of those would be 6 inches by 6 inches. If we're using 1-meter imagery, my math is failing me at the moment, but it would be several across by several across would be the most detail that that we could see. So the data that we've been developing is what happens if we go in and we figure out what is the tree canopy, what is the impervious surface, what is the disturbed land, and so land that really doesn't have anything growing on it, but it doesn't appear to be cropland, doesn't appear to be used for agriculture. It's kind of a measure of what was being developed at the time, what had been cleared off, and was in a stage of transition. And the impervious surface being all of the roads, all of the parking lots, all of the streets. In terms of the, and panning across, we can kind of see some of the detail where we're not talking about just groups of trees, you know, but we're talking about specific trees that we can see and identify as part of that. If we add on the tree species association, and I know we usually think about trees being green, but if we try to throw on 11 different classes of green on top of it, it's kind of hard to pick out what the patterns are. So we took a detour into the colorful spectrum. We can start to see some of those other patterns of trees that are urban forests, they're planted landscapes, you know, as part of a commercial development or a residential development. Some of the younger mixed hardwood forests over here and the older hardwood forests, little bits of red cedar mixed in, and being able to see those types of patterns, not only by the neighborhood, but this is going to take a second to zoom out. There's an awful lot of data there. But also the pattern, still a lot of data across the city as a whole. This also illustrates one of the challenges of this project. We're working with so much data at such a fine resolution that several times we kind of bump up against the limits of what our technology can provide in terms of processing power. And so we've been working through lately is taking these nearly 200 square miles of land use land cover polygons, hundreds of millions of polygons, each of these little different shapes, and going through making sure that what that polygon says it is actually what's in the picture beneath, and then making sure that each of those little polygons don't overlap and that there are no gaps in between them. Yes, sir.
What's the difference between the old and the young on the hardwood forest?
I'm not sure what the age breakdown is, but it would tend to infer, is it more old growth? Is it something that's been disturbed previously by development? Or it's that hasn't been disturbed by development? Or is it something that some neighborhoods that might have been developed 50, 60, 70 years ago, and some of those trees, you know, remaining from that are growing back a little bit. So we have not only quite a colorful map, but quite a detailed map of different patterns in the city. I do. Put back to my other screen and let that load so we can see what the picture of that so where we're at right now on this project is doing those final steps of the quality assurance and quality control of the data. The deliverables that we have available are the imagery, 2007 imagery is that same imagery that we have in the City View interactive map, and the tree canopy that's in that interactive map are two deliverables that we already have out there to city staff, to the public, to anybody with internet access. The next deliverables that we're working on is taking those land use land cover maps, the one of just those six classes with the forest, water, impervious surface, crop, disturbed, and grass, and then the version that has all that tree species information, and incorporating that in a way that we can have access to that through the City View city web map, and using that as the optimal method to enable people to see what's going on in their neighborhood, in their community. And so we hope to have that done by the end of this month, getting to the stage of cleaning up that data, then making it available in such a way on the technical side where it won't take as long to reload as it's reloading for me up here right now. Along with that, the long-term goal was to provide that data in a format that would be accessible and available to researchers at the university, or university students, or folks in the public that want that data. And so coming up with a method by which, chunked out by watershed, to make the data a little bit less so that we can have that data up on the website available for anybody who wants it. And then with those projects completed, then use that same final version of the data and go back and complete the analyses for the final version of the NRI report. In terms of levels of data summary, the NRI report summarizes all those, how much impervious surface is there, how much of this tree species is there for the area as a whole, for the City of Columbia, and by each of the 29 different immediate watersheds that we have that overlap our natural resource area. The other aspect of the level of data summary that will take a little bit longer is taking all that same information as it lays out on the map and incorporating that into City View so that when you go on and click on a parcel, in addition to seeing when was your property annexed, who's the property owner, who's your council person, what are the city utilities, you'd also be able to see, whatever percent of this parcel is forest, whatever percent of this parcel is impervious surface, and try to provide that information out at the parcel level as well. So that is the overview and kind of status update of where we're at. We kind of see this as tying to an end, but at the same time, this is just kind of wrapping up the 2007 baseline, the snapshot in time. While it's useful information, while that report will be great to help us and staff understand what's going on in the city, it really is just a picture that we took in June of 2007. The long-term plan would be at a set frequency, let's do another leaf on flight, let's process the data again, and then we can do the not only what's going on in the environment at this snapshot in time, but we do it the same way so we can say what's the change in impervious surface, what's the change in tree canopy, what's the change in tree species, for whatever area that we look at. And so while this is a long project that's coming close to an end, it also hints at a much larger, a much more long-term, a much more potentially valuable ongoing research project for the city and those living in the city to understand not only what's in our community, but over time how the community changes. So happy to entertain other questions.
Any questions?
So as areas are, let's say, cleared and developed, you won't be updating the map as we go. The map will only be, the information will be updated periodically rather than for some major things.
There, one of the things we have learned from this process is not only what data it's helpful for the city to have, but what data would be really helpful if we kept up operationally as we went along. There is certainly potential, I think, for things that we've learned from this process of data that we could keep up in a more regular fashion. The issue is or the issue has been, can we get this data set to the point where we can archive that, make a copy of that, say this is 2007, and then take a copy of that and, all right, we're going to try to change, we're going to try to update this. There isn't a lot of leaf on imagery flown. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has flown it for Boone County every year since 2003, except for 2008 and 2012, but it's not six-inch imagery. It tends to be one-meter imagery. And so what we run into the balance with is what imagery is available. Is it leaf on or leaf off? And does the resolution of that imagery support the same resolution of this data set that we've been trying to develop? Certainly for some of the data in here, there is areas of city interest that we could certainly look at updating operationally as it changes over time with the best available reference data sources.
In terms of keeping it up, and I came late, so you may have already said this, but I remember when the flyover was done in 2007, and it was always coming. And I gather what happened was the technical side of this, you mentioned some of the data processing and so forth, was rather complex. I'm wondering if money was found for more frequent flyovers, how much of the, what percent of the work and what percent of the cost is the flyover and what percent of the work is the really remarkable data processing and storage and all of that that you've worked out, so that, in answer to Barbara's question, would it be possible to more cheaply keep this up or keep up parts of it? I don't know what the flyover costs. I met one of the pilots once who's a private pilot who does this for different cities. So anyway, so that's the question, is what, do you have any idea, a guesstimate of how much is the cost of the flyover and how much is the cost of the data processing, and how much of the data processing that you've done would apply to keeping things up to date?
I have an idea of the numbers from 2007, but the market and the technology has changed so much, I'd kind of be hard-pressed to give a better number of that. And over the course of the process, I think that the city has learned quite a bit about what we do differently if we had a chance or when we have a chance to do it again. Currently, the state contract for a square mile of aerial imagery is neighborhood of $100, a square mile for 6-inch imagery. But that's kind of factored by how big of an area you're flying, the resolution that you're flying it in, and the vendor that you're using, and if they've flown the area before to kind of set up the grid.
So it sounds cheap in terms of, let's just say 65 square miles, $6,500. I guess the real work and the challenge has been what to do with the information, which must be massive. And, could you, and then as you said, what you'd like to do would be sort of like archive 2007, and then you'd have like other flyovers. Now, it sounds like you already have the data for a number of different years, although I don't know if all of those were the 6-inch grid.
It's kind of balancing out a number of factors, and you know, not only with generating the land cover map, but also in terms of the analyses for the port and trying to keep maybe some of those up to date. That does consume a fair amount of staff time.
Yeah, because see, what would be fascinating would be to have the archives of, you know, snapshot as of each point in time, but also to update the areas that have changed, you know, where there's been major development. And, you know, then of course there would be the massive software project. If somebody wants to look at like a movie of, you know, how a development area has changed. So this is really quite a remarkable IT project. I'm very impressed.
I'd just like to make a quick comment. I believe, and Mr. Teddy can correct me if I'm, but I believe we used the NRI when we did our East Area Plan, when I was a Planning and Zoning Commissioner, and this tool was invaluable, I think. You know, in terms of doing growth management planning or any kind of area plan, land use plan, you know, to have this kind of level of detail and look at the areas where you think there might be growth or where there shouldn't be growth, it was just an invaluable tool. So very thankful to have it and eager to have it updated.
Okay. Thanks very much, Matt. We'll move on to discussion of roll cards. You'll remember we had a work session, council work session, about a year ago, and this is a follow-on to that.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, we talked a little bit about natural gas and converting, you know, or changing our vehicle system over to use natural gas for the fleet. One of the early business units that we want to look at is solid waste, and while we're doing that, we want to look at our business model as well and how we collect the trash and how we do all that and how we bill for it. So. Richard Wieman, our solid waste manager, is here to present this report. Richard.
Hi. Thanks, John. Good evening. We have staff has put together a much larger report concerning the opportunities that are out there and looking at roll cards and automated collection. The full report's in the Public Works Department, but this evening I'd like to go over just the highlights of that report. Briefly, I'll review what solid waste history has been here in Columbia. What are roll carts exactly? Types of vehicles that it takes to collect from roll carts. Talk about the disadvantages and advantages. Touch upon the financials and then take a look at a timeline for this project. Collection history goes back to 1970 when Columbia changed from trash cans at your house to trash bags at the curb. It was a big change for Columbia back there. I lived through almost most of that. I came on board with the city in 1975, so I've seen a lot of changes in the city over the years. We added yard waste and recycling bags in 91 and 98 respectively when we started our blue bag program in 98 and our yard waste program in 91. So currently we have a three bag program, trash, yard waste, and recycling bags. The current system is an unlimited amount of trash removal at your home curbside. If you place a couch out there, we remove it. If you place 20 bags out there, we remove it. The service is offered to the residents using rear-loading collection vehicles. Pretty standard in the industry. It's been in the industry since the 30s or so when they were first used. And we use two men per truck, one generally at the back of the truck and one a driver, and they rotate off throughout the day. What are roll carts? There are many communities around Columbia that already have roll carts. Jeff City is one, Fulton is another. The picture here shows an example of a particular type of roll carts. There are many industries that produce roll carts, different style, different types. Primarily, you see different sizes. This picture represents three different sizes, a 32, which is the green one, 64, which is blue, and 96, which is a traditional cart used in the industry for trash removal. The collection vehicle is an automated vehicle where one man operates it. Currently, as I mentioned, we have two men per truck to operate the manual collection. This is an automated collection where the driver uses that yellow mechanical arm to reach out and retrieve the roll cart, bring it back to the truck, unload it, and set it back at the curb. What are the advantages of roll carts? For Columbia, because we are on a bag system, because we are on a manual system, we can actually implement roll carts, introduce them into Columbia, buy the vehicles, purchase the carts without a rate increase. Roll carts are essentially as a pay-as-you-throw system, and that's a buzzword in the industry, has been for many, many years. That means it's a volume-based system. Let's say, for example, on a 96-gallon roll cart, you can put six bags of trash in there. You have your seventh bag, what are you going to do with it? Or your eighth bag, or you have a chair that you want to throw away. Typically, what you see in other industries, and the report actually reviews other cities, and that information is available in the report, and I think it was also, as part of this presentation, emailed to you, to the council. You can take, other cities typically charge extra for those types of collections, that the material that's placed outside the roll cart either gets a sticker or some other provisions made for collections. So the term pay-as-you-throw means here that if you generate really more trash than what goes in the roll cart, you pay more. Some people like that system. If you generate a small amount of trash, you're going to pay the least amount of trash or least amount. If you generate a large amount of trash, you're obviously going to pay more. Pay-as-you-throw system, it's not uncommon. Moberly, Missouri has a pay-as-you-throw system now. Typically, you see them with trash bags and roll carts, either one. Automated trucks, there are lots of advantages to automated trucks. There's some disadvantages, which we'll talk about later, but you can imagine the manual labor that's required on the back of a refuse truck, working 8 hours a day, picking up an equivalent of 20 tons of trash per day per truck. The guys are really, really tired at the end of the day. If you do this 5 days a week and for many years, then it takes a toll on your body. Automated trucks, on the other hand, the driver stays inside the truck in the comfort of the truck, an air-conditioned truck, uses a mechanical arm to retrieve the roll cart that you saw in the earlier picture, brings it back to the truck, unloads it, and sets it back at the curb. So the employee enjoys a much better atmosphere. The employee can generally work longer hours during the day, and typically you see them able to work longer years. I know that our refuse collectors start out young. They start out on the collection route, and they move toward the more automated trucks, which we have in the commercial side. As they get older, they work their way into those trucks because a body just can't handle that amount of work for 35 years or so. When you do a conversion to any type of a new system, it gives you an opportunity to take a look at changing many things. One of the opportunities that are here in Columbia is to change from a diesel-powered vehicle to an alternative energy like compressed natural gas. We are looking at 10 trucks that it would take to make this conversion. This is just on the residential side. The commercial side fleet would remain the same. The recycling fleet would remain the same. So we would be purchasing 10 new residential trash collection trucks, and it gives us the opportunity to purchase those to be powered by compressed natural gas versus diesel, and there are certainly some advantages to that. I mentioned that this type of work using an automated truck is a lot easier on the employees, and it is. What we're seeing across the surveys that we conducted is about a 75% reduction in workers' compensation cost. That's definitely an advantage.
Can I ask a quick question? I'm sorry to interrupt. How about the number of workers? Is that also reduced, or?
The number of workers would be, for the program to move forward, would be reduced by 4. Yes. Typically, during a week or a month, we get multiple calls about animals ripping open and tearing the bags to get to the contents. I'm sure you all have received those calls yourself. A roll cart system would eliminate that. The carts would also give us an opportunity to track customers and provide notification for features that would be part of the cart and the truck, that there would be a computer chip in the cart, and when the truck goes by, grabs hold of the cart and dumps it, it would log that information in, and then we would be able to tell whether or not the customer, what time of the day we were there, when, you know, when the truck was dumped. You can take that a step further and actually weigh the amount of trash that's in your containers if you wanted to. You can use that information to provide notification to customers if any changes. For example, during a holiday week, you can send out a notice and say, we're going to collect your trash on Wednesday and not Tuesday as it is normally scheduled. So there are some advantages to have the service tracking like that. The automated system enabled to work longer would give us some flexibility with scheduling work days. Right now we're at 5 8-hour work days during the week, and we could go to 4 10-hour work days. The advantage on that would be to be able to better manage the holiday schedules. That would reduce our cost, reduce our overtime, rather than having to work on Saturdays, and our refuse collectors would finally get a true holiday where they wouldn't have to work the following Saturday after a holiday. Work can be performed during all sorts of weather. The good weather as today, the heat that's coming, and the winter that we normally see here. Pretty hard on the workers hanging onto the back of a truck. Those are some of the good advantages. There's also disadvantages, as with any program. Carts may remain at the curb. Right now, when our workers go through the area, they clean up everything that's left at the curb. They throw away your bags, they throw away your extra chairs, they throw away your boxes, pick up recyclables, and if you look down the street after collection, it's relatively clean. Carts will remain at the curb for at least some period of time. Whether you find that attractive or not is, I guess, up to you. But that is a problem with carts. I suppose that there would be an ordinance that would be implemented that would restrict the time for which carts could be at the curb, similar to our trash out early ordinance right now that limits the time in which trash bags can be placed out at the curb. Bulky items will not fit into a cart. As I mentioned, a chair, if you wanted to throw away a chair, you must pay extra for it. You can obviously put a certain number of trash bags in a cart. Any more than that is an overflow. We go back to the pay-as-you-throw issue, so it could possibly cost our customers more money if they have a larger volume of trash. Carts can be lost or stolen, although we're not seeing that as a problem in other cities. They tell us that's really not an issue. Columbia is the only city in the state of Missouri that's allowed to put yard waste in the landfill right now because we are a bioreactor landfill. That does have a sunset for us, although we think that the EPA is going to allow more landfills across the country to become bioreactors. We do have a 12-year sunset on our bioreactors. Upon losing that sunset, if EPA does not reauthorize the bioreactors, then our yard waste exemption would go away along with that, which means then yard waste would need to be handled in addition to the trash for collection at the curb. Parking, especially in East Campus area, could be an issue. I mentioned the 12 years on the yard waste approval. We believe that residents will continue to use the plastic bag in lieu of just throwing your trash in a roll cart. Right now, we're providing the the plastic bags as part of their monthly fee, so I'm not sure at that point what the ratio or what the trade-off would be, how much savings would be there for the actual customer. Carts get dirty and they need to be cleaned, and whose responsibility that would need to be addressed. Looking at the financial part of this picture, capital cost to implement for both carts and the trucks is $5.8 million. And that is doable. We can move to the cart system without a rate increase. Our current monthly fee is $15.42. And I need to explain that, because the $15.42 covers quite a few areas. It covers the mold sites in town. It covers the household hazardous waste program. It covers the recycling program. It covers the drop-off recycling containers that are around town. So there's a lot that makes up that $15.42. It's not just the fee for collecting trash itself. The actual cost in 2011 for collecting trash at the curb was $9.18 per household per month. Our estimate right now for moving toward roll carts is $8.30 per month, so you can see that there would be a savings there if moving to roll carts. As a question was asked earlier, would we have the same number of employees working for us? No, those numbers of employees would be reduced down, and that's essentially where your savings comes from. Carts, trucks can be leased. They can be straight out lease. They can be through a lease purchase. There's many different options. Carts or trucks can be leased together or separately. There are companies out there willing to do both. How long is it going to take to implement this? Part of the puzzle is the whether or not the city chooses to go with compressed natural gas. If compressed natural gas is a part of this, then that station would need to be built prior to any type of decision to order trucks for changing the fleet to an automated truck to utilize the roll carts. If that decision is made prior to any conversion to roll carts, then it takes about 12 months to implement this program from beginning to end. The program can be implemented without going to compressed natural gas. We would just purchase the vehicles in the standard diesel fuel combination. Again, the opportunity here to convert a pretty large fleet, 10 trucks, to an alternate fuel is attractive. But the timeline, we can implement this in 12 months.
One of the things Richard didn't talk about is we did a survey a few months back with the citizens, and it was about a 50-50 yes, no. So they're kind of split right down the middle whether they want to do this or not. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
That was going to be my first question on the survey. 50-50?
I was going to ask something about the survey, too. Was that the survey of people who actually had the pilot program, or the survey in general of residents?
It was independent. We did it on, I believe, on the website, and it was independent of those bins that we did in Park 8 as well as, I can't remember the other one.
The north part of Columbia, yeah.
But for the people who actually had the pilot project, their response for liking it was pretty high, as I remember. Didn't you do a follow-up sort of survey with them?
Yes. Now, the survey that you're referring to is the recycling survey using two separate bins for the collection of the containers of recyclable or the fibers in one bin. And initially, we had a grant to take a look at that, Columbia, to see if we can impact the quantity of material that's being recycled. And the survey, after we completed that one-year pilot, was very positive toward the bins. And we saw the quantity of recyclables increase significantly. So that part we felt pretty good about. But because this was coming down the pike, we put that survey and that project on hold until this project is determine which way it's going to go. Trash, any changes to the trash program is certainly going to have a change to the recycling program as well. If you go to a pay-as-you-throw system, we would expect the volume of recyclables to jump up considerably, which would be a great thing.
The $6 million number, almost $6 million number you had for equipment, did that include new trucks?
Yes, new trucks and carts.
How often do we replace those trucks on a normal cycle?
These trucks would be on a six-year replacement schedule, I believe, and the bins on a 10.
Okay. And how much would you save on fuel estimated by going to natural gas a year?
It's an equivalent of about a dollar a gallon, and these trucks here are just on the residential side. I can tell you what the budget number is. It's about $300,000 a year in fuel for the residential fuel. So
it would cut that by?
Cut that about maybe 25%, maybe.
Has anyone figured out the payout on doing this, how many years it would take to come back even if we didn't do anything?
Well, the payout's interesting on this because the actual cost is immediate savings as far as manpower. Right now, the two-man truck, we have 8 two-man routes that go out and do residential trash, 16 people. We would put out 8 automated trash trucks. So there's a difference of 8 employees right there. We also, to initially phase this in, have added 2 bulky item trucks because we anticipate a problem with that conversion. And those are 4 employees. So 8 and 4 is 12 when we originally have 16. So there's immediate savings of 4 employees. And later on down the road, as our customers become accustomed to this, we think that that'll be reduced.
If you purchase 10 new trucks all at one time, how would you stagger those so that some are replaced and some are kept? And how would you do that, John? They're all brand new at the same time?
No, we would stagger them out just like we would.
Just run some longer?
Yes. Some last longer than others. We anticipate them lasting, 6 to 8 years. Some of those will have to go longer, of course.
What's the difference in cost on one of these trucks versus?
It's around $40,000, aren't they?
A CNG vehicle adds $40,000 to the cost per truck.
That's a natural gas vehicle?
Yes.
Yes.
What about the arm on the truck? Is that more? That makes the truck more expensive, also, right?
No, they're.
I guess
really,
because you could do that anyway.
You're just replacing the back end of a hydraulic system with the side of a hydraulic system. The trucks are going to be equivalent in cost. For the automated truck versus a standard rear loader, the difference we're talking about here is the compressed natural gas part of it.
Can I just go back to the recyclables? Do those go in the bin also, the one bin that's dumped into the truck, or what happens to the recyclables?
What happens
under the new system?
The recycling program, if we implemented roll carts for trash, would not change at this point. We're not recommending any changes to the recycle program.
So either the bins or the bags would be separate to the cart?
Yes.
And be picked up separately?
Yes.
You mentioned that some neighborhoods may be problematic doing this. You mentioned East Campus, if there's a lot of parking in the street. Is it possible to exclude certain areas where it's going to be difficult to implement successfully?
Absolutely, sure. Especially in an area like that you can identify where parking is a problem, they could continue with the current collection method and hopefully later on over the years, then they could be integrated into the new system.
There are generally other cities adopt a put-it-in-the-driveway approach. So you put the cart right in the driveway on the side and those arms are pretty movable. That's like your own arm, And so there are days you just can't get it, but there are many days you can. So there are a mixture of approaches to make that work.
Correct.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You weren't done.
Do we have consideration for the elderly and the handicapped? or those people who live in an area, there's some areas that have really steep driveways. And I will tell you that I'm 110% for these, but everybody who has talked to me is elderly and is 1,000% against it.
We make accommodations for those today, some of those.
Mm-hmm. And we'll keep doing that.
Well, and see, that gets into the, are you really going to be able to do it with one man on a truck? Because what do you do for the exception? Somebody's going to have to get out of the truck and go get the bin for this person. And this gets into the parking. I neglected to bring it tonight, and I don't know if you've seen it, but the Wall Street Journal had an article, big, long article in the middle of the A section on, I think it was Cincinnati, and the savings failed to materialize because they were banking on the labor savings, and they found that they often needed to put a second man on every truck because there were whole neighborhoods with, you know, cul-de-sacs or another problem, all sorts of places where the arm couldn't reach. Now, it may be that, I don't know if you've seen that article, and it may be that the manufacturers of the arms have addressed that to make the arms longer or whatever, you know, whatever. So I'm very interested in two things. One is the fuel savings, if we're banking on the fuel savings, plus this would be the first investment in CNG, I guess, for a first fleet investment for something that we foresee as one, green, and two, going down the road, everything new coming in can be CNG, and then we're supporting that network of CNG stations around the country that could be available to the public. So it would, you know, even if it ended up not saving money, I could see reasons being for this if we think the CNG is where the savings are going to come from. And, you know, when I read the Cincinnati article, I thought, okay, well, this is really great. They're spending the same amount of money, and they've let people go. These are, you know, hard jobs, but they're jobs for people who don't have college degrees, and we're replacing them with machines, and we're not, you know, they're not saving money. Now, Cincinnati wasn't.
You know, we probably wouldn't be talking about this had it not be for CNG. CNG shouldn't be the reason we do this.
I see.
It should be, are we going to do this for efficient solid waste collection and those kind of things in the future? I mean, right. CNG is the driver right now because we're looking at changing the whole fleet.
Let me address a couple other concerns. We have about 250 residents right now in which we provide assistance for, to go up to their door and provide trash removal at their residence. When you divide that out with the number of routes that we are looking at 40 routes a week, then you're really talking about four or five stops per day per truck to do that. And we felt that that was doable because, mm-hmm. one, our house count is much lower than what we think the trucks would be capable of doing, mostly because, you know, we're growing and also we're getting into this, we're new into it. But we certainly think that that's doable, and that's, mm-hmm. that's not going to be an issue.
Another thing we could do is if an elderly person needed 96, we could at the same cost give them three of the smaller ones or something like that. Or, I don't know, there's certainly got to be some option that an elderly person can handle.
Yes.
And it may be that you've already figured out, it sounds like you've already figured out some of the problems that Cincinnati had where they didn't save money, although it didn't cost them money. we'd be getting into the CNG and also looking at, you know, there's a real potential for savings. And if I understand the Cincinnati article right, they didn't lose money by conversion, but what they did is they lost jobs replacing them with machines.
I'm familiar with the Cincinnati article, yes.
Ah,
but
good.
There are actually more success stories out there using carts than there are stories like those from Cincinnati.
And if you're aware of that, you could...
Widely used across the country and accepted across the country.
And if you're aware of what went wrong in Cincinnati, then you can address that. And, I have had 100% of my complaints, which is one, which was from an elderly resident saying she couldn't move the cart. And I was pleased to see the small cart option. And I don't know if we can figure out something that works for people with disabilities or, you know, there must be some answer to that, which would be on a per cart basis.
Yes, all that is certainly doable. And our customers can have a smorgasbord of cart sizes. They can have the 32, 64, the 96, what it's whatever the council wants to design this program to be. Mm-hmm. They can have two 96s if they wish. Again, I would expect that second cart to cost more than just a single cart by itself. Mm-hmm. Many ways to present this program and giving our customers opportunities to pick and choose what works for them.
Right, and some people will complain about having to pay more for volume, and other people will be pleased to pay less for less volume because they do recycle and so forth, and right now they get no discount for that. So there will be a lot to look at in terms of pricing.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let's start the council meeting promptly in 5 minutes.